Just in this moment, looking here at your faces, I feel so much happiness. I'm so happy to be here. It's been almost 2 years since I've been in this space, in this seat. And hopefully it's like riding a bicycle. We'll see. So one of the beautiful things about retreat practice is that we have this opportunity for continuity of practice, that the whole time you're here on retreat, it's practicing. It's just that the frame changes from sitting to walking to eating to doing your yogi job. And now we're coming into the frame of Dharma talk meditation. I liked Don's reminder last night to remember that you have a body and maybe sense into the way that you can listen, not just from the conceptual mind to the content of my talk, but to listen with the body that resonates when you hear truth or something that's meaningful or useful to you. And I do have a lot of content because that's just the nature of my mind. So if it's too much content, you can just let the vibrations of my voice wash over you, have that be a different kind of vibrational meditation. One of my favorite teachings, something that really transformed my practice, comes from a story of, you know, Buddhism originating in northern India. And almost as soon as the suttas were learned and recited, they got transmitted to China. Just quite an amazing thing if you think about it, like different culture, different language, difficult terrain. And the Chinese were always trying to synthesize these teachings into some, you know, coherent wisdom, knowledge. But there kept more Dharma kept coming and coming. So it was a difficult task. It took about 1,000 years actually for the Chinese folks to really grok the essence of the teachings. And about that time, 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha, a great Chinese sage wrote a treatise about the Dharma. And in that treatise, he synopsized the entire Dharma into one pithy phrase. And I love these pithy summations of large things. Do you want to hear it? Okay, he said, awakening, and we could use so many words here, nibbana, liberation, freedom, enlightenment, the unconditioned, the deathless, the extinguishment of greed, hatred, and delusion, all these so many ways that the Buddha described this state of being. Awakening beckons from within everything. Awakening beckons from within everything. And I love this idea of beckoning. It's like literally all of life's experience, all the 10,000 sorrows and the 10,000 joys are all calling out to us to wake up, to realize our true nature, to step out of all the prisons that we construct for ourselves and into this field of the deathless, the unconditioned, this field of loving awareness. And the heart longs for this freedom. I think it's the reason that many of us are here or found this practice. It's definitely the reason that I'm here. And yet somehow, we often don't hear this call. Like we're in a culture that where busyness is a kind of badge of honor. So to make time for stillness and introspection is often difficult. We are constantly barraged by thousands of ingenious, insidious messages across various platforms and devices crafted to hijack our attention. And many of them are telling us that we're broken, that we need this product or this pill, or we need to look a certain way. So we can come to think that if we want to be happy, we need X, fill in the blank. More money, a better job, a different place to live, a relationship or a different relationship, a different government, my favorite these days. Desires are endless. Or we might think to be happy that we need to get rid of something. As Kittasara says, if only this back pain would go away, or these unpleasant emotions, or people who bother us. Or maybe we're caught up in the worry. There's so much actually legitimately to worry about in our world, our planet, our climate. So much injustice and inequity. And maybe it's too much, so we just zone out. The mind is in a fog and we're kind of in a haze of exhaustion. Or if we're not getting there, wherever there is, we might think we're doing it wrong, we're not a good meditator, we're not working hard enough. Or maybe we think we're not worthy. Or we're sitting here thinking we should have gone to the sound bath retreat instead. So the Buddha spoke about these states of mind, the so-called five hindrances, states of mind and heart that capture our attention, and when we're captured by them, they hinder our capacity to be present with our experience. This list is familiar to many of you. Sometimes when you say the words five hindrances, there's an eye roll or a groan because it's de rigueur at pretty much every retreat. And I think that's because it's so foundational to this practice and so common in our experience. So I will list them and then I'll talk about each one a little bit. The five hindrances are, drum roll, sense desire, aversion or ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt. And the practice instruction from the Buddha is merely to notice the presence or absence of these states of mind with mindful attention. And I think it's really interesting that it's not just the presence. When we're restless, we can notice that we're restless. But it's also the absence, that it's seeing the causes and conditions that manifest in freedom from a hindrance is equally important. And the interesting thing is that the hindrances themselves are not actually a problem. Thoughts appear in the mind, like saliva in the mouth. They come, they go. They have very little essence. They only become a hindrance when we're unaware of them, caught in them, obsessed by them, struggling to fix them, and suffering as a result of them. My friend and fellow Dharma teacher Nisha Patel says that the ancient word for hindrance, nivarana, which I like that nivarana sounds a little bit like nirvana, which is kind of the point of my talk. I don't know if those words are related, but nivarana has an etymology that suggests being entranced or being caught in a spell. And when we're snared in the grip of a hindrance, it's often all we can think of. And it's like a black hole of gravitational pull that sucks our attention into it. But we can, through this practice, cultivate a kind of Teflon mind so the hindrances just slide off. They don't stick. Or if you're in my household, it's an eco nonstick pan where most of it slides off, but not all of it. Still pretty good, though. In the Buddhist teachings, there's a lot of discussion about the obstacles to awakening. We have the five hindrances. You'll hear words like poisons, taints, defilements, fetters. Almost seems as if the Buddha talked about obstacles more and less about what you actually get out of practice, which is quite different from our acquisitional mindset in the West. Like, what's in it for me? What am I going to get? But it kind of makes sense because it's not always easy to know or describe freedom. I mean, we can know it in moments where we're free, but they're often fleeting. But it's quite easy to identify and relate to the things that stand in the way of freedom. So it's an ideal place to practice. The Tibetan Buddhists have a saying, meditate on what provokes resentment. Meditate on what provokes resentment. It's not what we usually think of. And when you notice that a hindrance has appeared, you might look at your watch and say, right on time, my teacher has arrived. Awakening beckons from within everything. I've heard Buddhist teachers from Asia say that we should kill the defilements. And, you know, there was a meditation community whose motto was meditate and destroy. And here we kind of take the approach of, you know, just be present with them, feel them, allow them, mingle them with the breath as they gently transmute. And I think both have their merits. You know, perhaps there's a middle way. And I'm going to buck the trend. And sorry, Don, give you some hacks so that you have some skillful means to work with the hindrances. But also strongly suggest that you not be too quick to apply a strategy to try to get rid of them. The tendency is to want to get rid of them, but they're actually a very, very powerful teacher. Our meditation instruction is to know the presence or absence of a hindrance. So before we use a strategy, we can really investigate them deeply to feel the energy of the hindrance in the body, and its subtle and gross manifestations. Where is their energy? Where is their tension? What does it feel like to touch in the emotional sphere to notice how that energy is and how it's moving? So the first hindrance, sensual desire, is wanting something that is pleasing to the five senses. Nothing inherently wrong with that. The Buddha used some analogies to describe the hindrances, so I'll give you the analogies for each hindrance. The Buddha said that sense desire is like a body of water filled with dye. And so everything is colored by that. I don't know if it says this in the sutta, but I imagine that it's like a red, beautiful, colorful, desirable dye. And being free from sense desire is like being out of debt, free from debt. It's such a relief to be free from debt. Sensual desire has a quality of hiding or camouflaging. It's kind of like a strategy of when something's difficult, we think, oh, well, if I only got this thing, then things wouldn't be so difficult. The kind of hidden belief that if the desire is satisfied, that it will cure our suffering. But we all know sense desires by their nature are fleeting. Usually when we fulfill one, another pops up in its place. And often for me, when I pay close attention to that feeling of wanting or longing, that feeling, it's actually quite painful in itself. One of the things that comes up for me on retreat is wanting mental stimulation. And it's so strong that I can get this kind of gripping, intense boredom. The mind is so used to be so addicted actually to stimulation that it's actually quite painful when there's no stimulation. So I end up reading the bulletin board again and again. This is what poison oak looks like. This is how to remove a tick. Stay away from rattlesnakes. So this place of longing, of heartache, to locate that place of longing in the body is a very supportive ground for exploration. That sometimes, the teaching of the First Noble Truth, sometimes when we really become intimate and up close with our suffering, we almost, it's like enough already. You know, we can get kind of disgusted by that pattern of action. It's useful to reflect on the cost of preoccupation with desire, that we become very outwardly focused, that we can be so focused on the object of desire that it severs our internal connection, kind of becomes self-alienating. Another antidote to desire is to study the object of desire. Is it really that desirable? What are its disadvantages? How lasting will that satisfaction be? One contemplation that I have really enjoyed is Sometimes it's called contemplation of the repulsiveness of the body. This is a great thing to do if you are desiring another person. You begin to see them as a conglomeration of pus, bile, phlegm, and mucus, which definitely kills the mood. But of course, there's a time and a place you wouldn't do this on your honeymoon. Another useful reflection is, does this desire stimulate more desire? Like a potato chip, or looking at a fancy catalog, browsing Facebook and Instagram. Like, you just want more and more, and it's never ending. So another skillful way of dealing with sense desire is to steward or guard the sense doors, you know? Stay away from the bag of potato chips and the fancy catalog. The best antidote to desire, in my experience, is just something that emerges as a fruit of practice, that when we connect with an internal wellspring of well-being, something that comes from living in integrity and gathering and collecting and calming the mind, that feeling of wellspring is so joyful, so beautiful, that the objects that we want pale in comparison. The gift of practice is those beautiful moments remind us there is a better strategy for happiness and well-being. Now I'm going to talk about ill will, whether you like it or not. This is a range of experiences from anger, rage, hatred, irritation, frustration, annoyance, disliking, resentment, resistance, complaining. The Buddha said that this is like boiling water, and that being free from ill will is like recovering from sickness. Ill will has this energy of hostility, often like a wanting to strike or push away. So you can really feel into this impulse when it's there, like, ah. My favorite way to work with aversion is simply to take my meditation posture with some sense of relaxation and having a mental image of this body being a spacious container, and then just letting it rip. Being aware of where it manifests in the body, where's their energy, where's their heat, where's their contraction, where's their tension, where's the impulse to lash out, and what are the stories? What story have I created that's fueling this anger? And what's the feeling tone? We've begun to talk about this idea of vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And ill will is tricky because it often has aspects of pleasant and unpleasant. It's useful to reflect on the cost of ill will. It is painful, like a sickness usually. It takes a lot of energy. When I'm angry all the time, I'm usually quite exhausted. Can also reflect on the costs to others, to our relationships. Aversion is often multi-layered. Sometimes I find that aversion is covering over something more tender, more difficult to face, like grief or sorrow, hurt. Sometimes it's frustrated desire. Can't get what we want, so we get angry. A huge part of this practice for me has been learning to be comfortable with that which is unpleasant or uncomfortable. By and large, when we struggle with the hindrances, it's because we find them unpleasant. Practicing metta or any of the other brahmaviharas is an excellent antidote to anger. I can't resist. Why did the vegan get sent to anger management? They had a bad tempeh. What I love about meditation retreats is you guys will laugh at anything. Try telling that joke in a room full of lawyers in a conference room. So sloth and torpor is the next hindrance. This can be a range of experiences, both physical and psychological. It can be a physical sleepiness, a tiredness, a fogginess or dullness of mind, lethargy. Sometimes we call it sinking mind. The Buddha described this as a body of water filled with moss and algae. You can't really see through it. And to be free from sloth and torpor is to be freed from prison. This is one I know very well. I think many of us have our kind of go-to hindrance. Unfortunately, this is my go-to hindrance. Sometimes I experience this almost as if I've been drugged or tranquilized. So terrible. When we're caught in the hindrance of sloth and torpor, there's a kind of lethargy also that sometimes prevents us from taking some action. The physical component, many of us are quite tired. Many of us do not get enough sleep. If you wake up with an alarm, almost by definition, you're not getting enough sleep. And then there's a psychological component that sometimes there, that it's a way of checking out or avoiding more difficult emotions or more difficult sensations. What I have found helpful in working with sloth and torpor is a dance between really just giving in to the reality that sloth and torpor is present. Really feel that fogginess of the mind, that even when the mind is quite foggy and the body is tired and dull, the capacity for mindfulness is actually quite surprising. And we can be mindful of that cascade of experiences. Sometimes the awareness gets very, very dim, but you could still have as much awareness as you can muster is helpful. Sometimes just surrendering and like giving in, nodding off a little bit, mind sinking, something sort of like self-corrects in the energy. Sometimes it actually can be quite restful and useful. Sometimes torpor can come from a lack of clarity on what we're doing. Be kind of a form of like related to doubt that, you know, we get confused about the instructions and so we just kind of zone out. Sometimes it's just a balance of the energies. You know, we've alluded to the seven factors of awakening, and in the seven factors of awakening, investigation, energy, and joy are enlivening factors. So when the mind is dull or tired, we can spend a little bit more energy on that investigation. Touch into joy. Tranquility, concentration, and equanimity are relaxing factors. So when we get to restlessness and worry, we can use those to balance the energies. Mindfulness, interestingly, is quite neutral. And then there are just the things you can do to manage the energy in the body in very practical ways, like walking briskly, doing whatever you can to lighten the body. Sometimes I'll just put really cold water on my face and head as a way of waking up, to sit up straight or stand during your meditation, to open the eyes, to take in more light, to also to give the mind something to do is quite useful when the mind is dull. Some activity that the mind can gather around. So, budo, it's a little small thing to give the mind, or to count the breaths, or to use mental noting, maybe using mental noting more often to note your experience as it's happening. One technique I really like, which these ones that give the mind something to gather on, they kind of work for all the hindrances because concentration is kind of a universal antidote to the hindrances. But one of my favorite tips is to do a 4-point body scan. So you just feel like your feet rested on the, feel into your feet resting on the floor. Feel into the belly. Feel into the heart. Feel into the top of the head. Feel into the feet. Gives the mind a little activity, helps with embodiment, helps gather the mind. No more hindrance. The next one is restlessness. Sometimes you hear remorse, regret, or worry thrown in there. The Buddha said this is like water stirred by wind, and that freedom from restlessness is like being freed from slavery. This one is quite familiar, I think, to most of us. Sometimes we call it the monkey mind, that grabbing for the next thought and the next thought and the next thought. And it's said that restlessness remains in the mind until complete awakening. It's like the last fetter to be released. And I find this somewhat relieving, actually. You don't have to sweat it too much. If not this lifetime, then maybe the next. Sometimes a successful meditation for me is just being able to stay in my seat for the allotted time. There's so much restlessness that I count that as a victory. And this is another hindrance where you can really just allow a kind of spaciousness of heart and mind and just let it do its thing. Feel the discomfort, the vibration, the butterflies, however it manifests in the body. With discernment, allowing that energy to move and transform. Sometimes, for me, just giving it permission, giving whatever hindrance is there permission to be there is helpful. Like, that idea of allowing, so I'm not just fighting against it. And then ways you can manage the energy of the body. You know, sometimes just focusing more on the exhale breath, which has the quality of settling and calming and relaxing, can help with restlessness. Invoking a sense of grounding, feeling the support of the earth wherever your body is supported, bringing the awareness there can help calm restlessness. You might investigate your use of caffeine and other stimulants. I actually find that on retreat, I need less caffeine. And sometimes if I don't moderate that, then I get very restless. And then there's a whole part of really all these hindrances, but restlessness in particular, where it's useful to investigate how your life is outside meditation. Like, do you live in a way that tends to promote restlessness? What activities do you engage in that are agitating? What activities do you engage in that are calming? Do you spend time jumping from thing to thing or endlessly doom scrolling? Do you stream a lot of high tension thrillers? Like, all these things affect us. And sometimes we don't even notice until we get here. And the din of activity and busyness dies down, and then what's left is a roar. So the last hindrance is doubt, which the Buddha described as water with mud stirred up in it. And freedom from doubt, this is probably my favorite. Freedom to doubt is like completing a desert crossing. You just feel the relief of having made it across the desert. Doubt can be doubt in the practice, doubt in yourself, doubt that you're doing it right, doubt about what practice you're doing. Maybe you think another path would be better. Maybe that breath work workshop would have been better. The Buddha said this is like a fork in the road, and we're confused about which way to turn. And in some ways, this is the most insidious of the hindrances because it can just carry us right off the path. When people leave meditation retreat, it's almost always in my experience because some doubt has arisen. And the best antidote to doubt is simply to recognize it as doubt. Oh, this is doubt. It's just doubt. Sometimes it's helpful when we have friends that can, or teachers that can point it out where it's not clear to us. My favorite stories of the Buddha are after his awakening, when Mara would come to visit him and taunt him with doubt, like, you're not really so great. You know, you claim to be this enlightened, but are you really? And the Buddha's response was always, Mara, I see you. And then Mara would, in some stories, Mara would vanish, or other stories, he would just like slink away dejected. And to contrast what I said earlier about, you know, kill the defilements, like you don't have to, he didn't have to kill Mara. He just had to notice Mara's presence. You can also borrow the faith of your friends and teachers. I was on a month-long meditation retreat in 2019 with Tanisar and Kittisaro, and Don and Juno were there, and I was having a very difficult time. The spirits in the mountain were very angry, and that's a sentence I never thought I would ever say. And I was allergic to the meditation hall. So I was sneezing, and my nose was running, and my eyes were watering. And I just was having so much trouble sitting there and just being present for all that. And Juno was sitting in my view. And one time I was just like, I got to get out of here. And I opened my eyes, and I saw her, and she was upright and serene and steady and appeared calm and graceful, and it inspired me. I was able to stay in my seat for that sit, and throughout that was early on in the retreat, and throughout the retreat she was like a beacon, like, this is possible. I have a friend that is doing this, so I can do it too. Usually we struggle with the hindrances when they are unpleasant. It's this paradigm that many of us live with, that the way to happiness and well-being is to arrange our lives just so all the things that are pleasant are right here, available to us, and all the things that are unpleasant are denied or pushed to the side, or ignored. But of course, it's unrealistic. You know, we can't arrange the world like that. If we could, we would all do that, and none of us would be here. We would just be off in bliss land. There are so many causes and conditions outside our control. Life comes in waves, and so much better that we learn to surf than be knocked over by those waves. I really like to think of this practice as a self-exploration practice rather than a self-improvement practice. I think we have a problem in our culture with this notion of self-improvement. And sometimes for me, it almost takes on a kind of violence, that we were negating something when we're trying to, in the name of self-improvement, that we discount who we are in favor of who we want to become. So I'd like to share a quote from Jim Sinclair, who's a prominent activist for the autistic community. And just to be clear, this is not a commentary about autism, and I have no basis to comment on that. And these are strong and nuanced words, but I share them because these words had a very powerful impact on me to see the way in which I sometimes relate to myself. So Jim says, when my parents say, I wish my child did not have autism, what they're really saying is, I wish the child I have did not exist, and I had a different, non-autistic child instead. This is what we hear when you mourn over our existence. This is what we hear when you pray for a cure, that your fondest wish is that someday we will cease to be, and strangers you can love will move in behind our faces. I recognize this in myself, and it's like a kick in the gut to feel the tragedy of this way of thinking. And also a beautiful reminder that we can despite whatever flaws we have or whatever things we, aspirations we have, that we can love ourselves just as we are in this moment. So there are universal antidotes to the hindrances. The first one is not a surprise, mindfulness. When we're aware of the hindrance as a phenomenon in the mind, in the heart, it's much harder for it to grip us. If we're just angry, then we're caught in anger. But if we're aware that anger is present in this heart, it's quite different. Quite more spacious, quite a lot more agency. Concentration, the mind being gathered, collected, unified, stable, calm, much easier to... Actually, it's two things. Like when the mind is concentrated, our mindfulness is much stronger. So there's that. And then there's such a joy and contentment that kind of comes with the mind being gathered, that the hindrances, if they're there, they just tend not to be a problem. Any of the seven factors of awakening are places to put your mind that are antidotes to the hindrances. Also, noble friendship, having wise friends, associating with the wise, as the sutta goes. That, you know, our state of mind, our state of heart is quite contagious. So if we're around people that are calm and serene and wise, we tend to be so. And then our friends also act as mirrors. You know, they can point out what we can't see clearly, as we can for them. So as I was saying, you know, so much of this practice for me has been to learn to tolerate more and more unpleasant experience in a way that sometimes it can just be like, oh, this is just unpleasant. Like, just unpleasant. Not the end of the world, not a catastrophe, not something that has to be solved immediately, that it's unpleasant. And the next moment, you don't know. And we build this capacity in our meditation practice in very simple ways. Like, maybe there's an itch that arises and we don't scratch it. And we feel the discomfort of not scratching an itch. Or maybe we stay still even though every fiber of your being wants to like run out of the hall screaming. Or maybe the feet are a little numb and we don't immediately adjust them, and that we just feel into that sensation. Or when grief comes, we touch into it more deeply and allow ourselves to grieve deeply. One of my teachers, Trudy Goodman, used to talk about retreats that she went to where you weren't allowed to move, and there were flies that would drink out of the corner of your eyes. We don't have that here, so don't worry. But that kind of practice, you know, like when you bring some resolve to your practice, and some traditions, you know, you just sit steady, stable, without moving for an hour, you know, that changes the relationship with the body, changes the relationship with suffering. It's a little bit like going to the gym, though. You know, you want to lift weights that are heavy so that you get stronger, but you don't want to lift weights that are so heavy that you get injured. You have to titrate what we take on, titrate our resolve with our how resourced we are in that moment. And the inspiration to cultivate this capacity for what's hard is from a recognition that life can be hard, that it comes in waves, that it's pendulum swings. More often than not, we don't control the causes and conditions that influence those things. So the practice encourages us to work with what we can learn to control, actually, which is our relationship with experience. Shanti Deva says, where would there be leather enough to cover the entire world? With just the leather of my sandals, it is as if the whole world were covered. Likewise, I am unable to restrain external phenomena, but I shall restrain my own mind. What need is there to restrain anything else? And with this kind of cultivation, we realize the blessing from the sutta that although involved in worldly ways, unshaken the mind remains beyond all sorrow, spotless, secure. And of course we want our experiences to be pleasant and easy and peaceful and happy. And when they are, we can savor that, really relish it. But at the same time, there is a kind of spiritual maturity in which we see that often the most profound insights and the most profound growth come out of periods of difficulty. That's been my own experience. To polish a jewel requires friction, that the way around is through, the obstacles themselves are the path. Whatever is in the way is the way. This is an excerpt from Tore Zenji's Bodhisattva Vow. How can we be ungrateful to anyone or anything? Even though someone may be a fool, we can be compassionate. If someone turns against us, speaking ill of us and treating us bitterly, it is best to bow down. This is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own attachments, the very ones that have made us suffer again and again and again. Now, on each flash of thought, a lotus flower blooms, and on each flower, a Buddha. May we share this mind with all beings so that we and the world together may grow in wisdom. This idea that the person or thing that is treating us bitterly is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free ourselves from our own attachment. This is the same idea as awakening beckons from within everything. And may we all heed this call. Thank you for your kind field of attention. Let's just sit for a few minutes. have a period of walking, and then the last formal sit at 9:00.